Hello, tailoring talkers, and welcome to Tailoring Talk with your host, Roberto Revilla, bespoke tailor and owner of Roberto Revilla London Suit and Shirt Makers. It's the podcast where I take you on a journey around the globe. We'll either be tailoring, talking, or talking tailoring, or tailoring the talk. We'll meet a host of amazing human beings, creators, self-starters, performers, and more, to learn about their journeys and the lessons they've learned. They share their top tips and life hacks to guide you on the path to success. Please support the show by subscribing, and it helps so much if you take a few seconds to rate and review. My guest today is a New York Times best-selling author and international lecturer. Blind since birth, he survived the 9/11 attacks with the help of his guide dog, Roselle. This story is the subject of his best-selling book, Thunder Dog. Through countless TV and radio appearances, feature articles and speaking engagements, he does much more than simply tell his 9/11 story. He continuously explores the broader lessons of his life and experiences to inspire and motivate audiences. Tailoring Talkers, I am so honored and privileged to have him here to do the same for you. Please join me in welcoming Michael Hingston to the Tailoring Talk Show. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. What an honor and what an introduction.
You're welcome. It really did not do you justice. So, Michael, where are you calling in from?
I am in Victorville, California, which is about 75 miles north and east of Los Angeles, up in the what's called high desert area. We're about 2,850 feet above sea level. So wow. We're kind of in the intermediate part of California, if you will. There are people who know full well that in the winter, you can go from the beach to the snow and ski in 2 hours. We're kind of in the middle of that. We don't really get the snow, but we get the cold weather. So it was zero Celsius this morning when I woke up. And that's typical in the winter. It's actually a little warm. It was about -4 or -5 earlier in the week. So we get cold weather.
So you've basically had London weather, or are experiencing London weather, because it's exactly the same over here.
Except we don't get much of the rain.
Ah, okay. We don't get much rain over here. That's a myth. I read a statistic that it's actually sunny more days in London than it is rainy. But I think the rainy days, like yesterday was a rainy day, and it really, I mean, it, you know, when it rains here, it, you really, really feel it. It's very gray and yeah, it's awful.
Well, here the issue is that we're in a valley. So the clouds, if they don't come over us, right over us, if they come up over the mountains, they dump their moisture before they get to us, and a lot of the precipitation is at the higher level. So we just tend not to get a lot of rain. So earlier in the month, when it was raining significantly around Southern California, we got maybe a 0.5 or 0.75 inches of rain.
Yeah. I was on a call with Miles Hansen recently. We recorded for the podcast, and he must be a bit further south than you, because it was all about, you know, surfing in the beach and hot weather. And I actually never realized that California parts, I guess, well, if you're that far up in the north and that high above sea level, then I'm so sorry, Michael. I've done the Brit thing by getting into talking about the weather. We love doing that over here.
It isn't. We're not that far north, but the altitudes go high. So that's why there's a lot of snow. But anyway, weather aside.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a nice part of the world to be. He's gone now. Fine. Sorry, my dog was bothering me again.
Mine's asleep over here on the floor, on the bed.
He's a working Cocker Spaniel, so he can kind of sense other dogs from, well, it's seemingly from 6,000 miles away. but okay, so let's kind of just go back to the beginning a little bit. So you came into the world without sight. First guide dog at the age of 14. So prior to that, you obviously are faced with I mean, huge adversity. Actually, anyone listening to this that thinks they're going through anything, I mean, it kind of puts things into perspective. But what was growing up like for you with that disability? And what kind of support did you have around you? And how much better did it get when you hit 14 and you got your first guide dog?
Well, so if we're going to be absolutely 100% technical, I was born sighted, but I was born 2 months premature and put in an incubator with a pure oxygen environment, which caused the retina to malform. So within hours or a day or two, I was blind. So essentially, I was born blind for all intents and purposes. But having a master's degree in physics, I get technical. But anyway, the doctors told my parents they should send me to a home because no blind child could ever grow up to amount to anything or contribute to society. And my parents both said, "You're wrong. He can do whatever he chooses to. We're going to give him that opportunity." And that was the key. That was the basis. They lived up to that. And so they, in fact, let me walk around our neighborhood. I was born in Chicago, and I walked around the neighborhood with my cousins and my brother and so on. Went to kindergarten, as children do in Chicago, at the age of 4, and actually went into a special class that was for premature children who were blind, because there were a number of us in Chicago, and my parents and others worked to get the school district to have a kindergarten class for us. So I actually learned Braille when I was 4. But then at the age of 5, my parents moved us to California. My dad got a new job out here. And so then I didn't have access to resources. We were in a little town called Palmdale, which is about 55 miles west of where I live right now. And I didn't have access to Braille. I didn't have access to writing tools or to anyone that knew anything about blindness, and actually even had to take a second year of kindergarten. But I went to class, and I studied with my parents at night. So I learned to do math with my father, who was an electronics and electrical engineer. And you have company. And
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. And
they appear in every episode.
Well, as they should. Someone has to be the star. So my father taught me to do algebra in my head by the time I was 6. And I was always math and science oriented. My mother helped with other aspects of studying and so on. So I was able to keep up. And then between 3rd and 4th grade, we learned that they actually hired a teacher called a resource teacher, somebody who knew Braille, somebody who knew about disability, specifically blindness. Because by the time I was in the 3rd and 4th grade, there were more blind kids in the area. And so then I started getting material in Braille, and then I started getting more direct access to things that other kids already had access to, but I got them in a form that I could utilize. And make no mistake, a significant part of that is Braille. So Braille is the means of reading and writing using a series of dots that blind people use. And a lot of people say, well, Braille is outdated because now you can listen to books and computer files or recordings and so on. And the answer is absolutely balderdash, that is not true. If Braille is outmoded and outdated, so is print for sighted kids. And you don't stop teaching sighted kids print. The reality is Braille is the means by which blind people, blind children, and adults learn to read and write. And everything else is sort of secondary. You can't learn to spell, diagram sentences, do other kinds of things that one needs to learn with recording like you can with Braille. So Braille is the basic means of reading and writing that we use. But anyway, I started using it again. And I went all around my neighborhood. I was riding a bike around my neighborhood. I rode a bike to school for the first few years until I started going to a school across town when we got into more intermediate grades. And so I just went to school and studied like everyone else did and had a lot of fun doing it. Was always interested in science. I got a couple of radio kits from my father. And then when I was 14, I got my amateur radio, ham radio license, and he waited until I could get mine so we could get them at the same time, which we did. And then about that same time, my parents applied to see if we could get me a guide dog. We had met a woman who used a guide dog. She was a blind teacher at Edwards Air Force Base, where my father worked, about 38, 40 miles from where we lived. And so through her, we learned a lot about being blind and growing up and learning about guide dogs, because she had a guide dog. And so they applied for me to get a guide dog. My parents did. And I got a guide dog between going to the eighth grade and into high school. Now, what most people don't understand is what a guide dog is and what a guide dog isn't. Mm-hmm. A guide dog does not lead a blind person. A guide dog doesn't know where I want to go. And I don't want my dog to know where I want to go. The dog's job is to make sure that we walk safely. Now, I could do that in elementary school and so on. I could hear well, and I was able to get around and do that, mm-hmm. and ride a bike and hear and so on. But going into high school, a much more crowded environment, and a whole lot different thing. I needed to have some sort of additional tool. There was nobody to teach white cane travel to me at that time, so I wasn't even using a cane, but I was extremely aware of my surroundings. I knew how to get from point A to point B or point X to point Y, and I could hear, but still going into high school with much more crowded and intense environments, it was wise to look at something else. And I was accepted to Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California. So between eighth grade and beginning of high school, we went up and I got my first guide dog, Squire. Hmm. So we worked at the school for 4 weeks, and then I came home and we started doing things like going over to the high school and learning all about where different rooms were, learning the layout of the school so that on any given day, wherever I had to go, I could direct my dog with commands and he would guide us there safely, which is what the dog does. So if you will, I'm sort of the navigator and the dog's the pilot, and yeah. the dog makes sure that we get there. But I have to tell the dog every step of where I want to go. I don't want to teach my dog, oh, go find room 320 at the school. What if I want to go to room 318? You know, mm-hmm. I can't have my dog doing that. I need to be aware and make those decisions. And how do I do that? Well, describing that would be as complicated as you describing how you do it through eyesight.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went through high school and it all went pretty well. Didn't generally seem to have much of a problem doing it, and made lots of teacher friends along the way. And I think I did a pretty good job in school, and then went to college at the University of California at Irvine. And by that time, I also had an opportunity to pick up a white cane and start to use it. It took me about 5 minutes to learn to use a cane. Mm. And I tell anyone today, I can teach any blind people how to use a cane in 5 minutes. Teaching someone to have the confidence to use the cane takes months, because the technique isn't the issue. It's being aware and understanding all the nuances of what you need to do in order to travel and get around. And that's no different for me than it is for you. Mm. The difference is you've got all sorts of signs that are up and other things that give you information that I didn't have access to growing up. A lot different now with GPS and other things with talking mm-hmm. smartphones. But back then, it was part of what I had to do. And I believe still have to do, because no matter what I use to get information about where to go, like with a talking GPS technology like Google Maps or whatever, I still have to be aware of my surroundings and focus Absolutely. And direct my dogs. So it's yeah. the same thing.
Yeah. What? Because you've been really self-sufficient prior to being accepted for the guide dog program. And thanks for the explanation, by the way, because I think sighted people, we do just assume that when we see a blind person with a guide dog, that this amazing guide dog has just been trained to know, you know, to kind of read your mind or something and kind of know where you want to go.
Pretty much. I was in a hotel several years ago. I was walking down a hall and I needed to make a left turn, and I knew the turn was coming up. And so mm-hmm. I was telling my dog left and giving hand signals and all that. And somebody was, or a family was behind me. And I heard one of the children say, when we turn left, how does that dog know where the left turn is? It didn't matter that I was giving the dog commands. It had nothing to do with it. I've had people walk up to me and say, I'm sorry, you can't see. You know, eyesight isn't the only game in town. And in fact, if we really want to put it in perspective, if you really want to deal with this, at least the way I think we should deal with it, you have as much of a disability being sighted as I do being blind. Mm. Your disability got covered up by Thomas Edison when he invented the electric light bulb. Mm-hmm. But make no mistake, if the lights go out and it's dark, you have a hard time getting around unless you can find a light source. Mm-hmm. So your disability is light dependence, pure and simple. And it's okay. We love you anyway. But don't assume that just because I am not light dependent, I'm light independent, that I am less capable than you. The real issue is disability does not mean a lack of ability. And disability is only a characteristic. And we need to get beyond thinking that it's horrible and I could be like them and that would be horrible and so on. We need to get to the point where we recognize that in reality, every person on the planet has a disability of some sort. Yeah. A lot of times we get it covered up pretty well. As I said, Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb or whoever did. But the bottom line is the disability is still there. It's just mostly covered up because we have technology that keeps it from mostly occurring to us, but it's still there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was thinking about how you then have to form a relationship and a bond with this animal.
Sure.
That's gonna help you through your day-to-day life. And I'm trying to shift that around in my mind as to how that might have been for you and how you developed that relationship. Because, you know, if I take, so we have two dogs. I told you about Emily, who's the princess, not a rescue. Although she was the one in the litter that nobody wanted. Because when we met her and her sister, we were kind of allowed to kind of go in the pen with them and sort of, you know, try and work out their personalities and work out which one we wanted. I wanted to get both. My wife said, no, we're only getting one dog. You don't even want to get a dog in the first place. You know, to cut a long story short, let's just say Emily wasn't actually the one that we chose. We chose her sister. But I think in the week it took for us to prepare our home and everything and then go back to collect her, they'd basically given the other dog, who was much nicer, as a little puppy, because the one we didn't want was very, she bit me and then snatched her sister's toy and ran to the other end of the crate.
A princess.
I don't, yeah, I don't want that one. I want the other one. And we ended up with the other one. But you know what? I wouldn't swap her for anything in the world.
I was just going to ask you that. Yeah.
Oh, I do. Bailey, on the other hand, our cocker spaniel, he's a rescue and we found him. We were just driving. We were on our way to the South Coast for a long weekend trip, and my wife spotted him from the car, just on the side of the highway. She spotted this little brown dog hopping along on three legs, and she said that dog looks like it's in real trouble. And so we stopped at the next intersection, came back around, and we managed to find him. Thank God. And there was no resistance. Like, you know, we went chasing after him. He came straight to us. He was in so much pain, malnourished. Mm. We managed to get him into the car. And the next job was to try and find some food and water for him and to go get help. I think in that moment when my wife was at the gas station and she was getting the water and some food, he just put his head on my lap. And he let out, you know, that really big sigh that dogs let out?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he just rested there. And I knew in that moment that he knew he was safe and that we weren't going to harm him. And the following months, the best part of a year, actually, Michael, the poor thing was in and out of hospital. He had 3 or 4 surgeries to fix his leg because it was broken in several places. We had to nurse him back to health, build him up because he was so undernourished. But, you know, he never leaves my side. You know, so that was building trust from him to me, or from him to us, I should say. I shouldn't leave my wife out of it. She's been such a huge part of it. But, you know, then kind of coming back to you, as a young boy who has been amazingly self-sufficient, I mean, how you managed to ride a bicycle to get around as well.
Well, it's all about listening. There's no magic to it. It's all about listening and using the senses that you have. I know plenty of people who can see, who ride bikes, who are very accident prone. It's probably the best way to describe it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But any of my friends listening to this will be laughing and agreeing with you, because they'll be thinking about me.
Well, and so here's the thing. Self-sufficiency has nothing to do with what the dog brings. The dog, or a cane, but the dog brings a new dimension to it. That is, the dog brings the ability to spot things to avoid, or to walk in the right place to keep us from bumping into people or other things that I might not have observed as quickly. And the dog does exactly that. But you raise a good point. It's all about trust and teamwork. I say regularly that I've learned more from working as a team with now 8 guide dogs since 1964 than I've ever learned from all the management theory experts and the Ken Blanchards and so on in the world, because we're putting it into actual practice. And it is a team. We each have a job to do, and we have to form a team from 2 different creatures who don't speak the same language, but who really do have the same goal. And the dogs take their jobs extremely seriously. They want to please. They want a pack leader, if you will. They want someone that they can look up to and who's going to look up to them and work with them and be part of their lives and be as devoted to them as they are to us. But make no mistake, although it's true, I think, that dogs do love unconditionally unless they're taught not to, they don't trust unconditionally.
Yeah.
They're more open to trust, but that trust still has to be earned. And so that is what we go through all the time when we get new dogs. But we create that trust, and when it works well, which it certainly can, when it works well, then the team is second to none. And I've been very blessed to have 8 very talented dogs that all pretty much formed good teams. One didn't. One dog, my 6th dog, only worked about 18 months and then just got really afraid of guiding. And the problem was, as I described Meryl, which was her name, she had a sort of type A personality. She couldn't relax. She couldn't play with the other dogs at home. She had to follow me around and even got testy if anyone came too close, any of the other dogs, and wanted to play. So she just got too stressed out too quickly. And so she wasn't able to continue to be a guide like other dogs were.
Yeah.
But the reality is that it is a team in every sense of the word. And when the dog is open to trust and the dog recognizes a soulmate, that is somebody else who's open to trust and wants to really form a relationship and is willing to take charge of the team and give the dog someone to rely on, there's nothing better that a dog likes. And I've seen dogs that weren't trusting. After September 11th, I went to work for Guide Dogs for the Blind, in part as a public spokesperson, for 6.5 years. And about a year after I joined, we had a contact from one of the departments that dealt with foster caring of dogs. And they had, in 2003, they had a dog that had come back. It was a 12-year-old golden retriever. It had never been a guide dog, but when it was in training early on, they said temperament made it not be a guide dog. And we think that she was just a very self-willed dog. So she didn't want to listen all the time. So her name was Panama. So Panama was sent back to live with her puppy raisers. And she did that for 6 years. But then her puppy raisers moved somewhere where they couldn't keep a dog. So Guide Dogs for the Blind found another place. Mm-hmm. And in 2003, that second family sent her back to Guide Dogs saying they couldn't keep her anymore. She came back filthy, dirty, totally unresponsive to any commands. There was a huge lump on her back. She was 12. She had arthritis. And they were convinced that she was totally deaf. And they needed a place to care for her. Mm-hmm. So we decided that we would take Panama. They were convinced she was deaf because they actually took a large Webster's dictionary and dropped it on the floor, and she didn't even react to it. So anyway, we took her home. And you should be aware, my wife also was a person with a disability that was visible. She used a wheelchair. She was in a chair mm-hmm. her whole life until she passed this past November. But she read, I pushed, worked out well. Well, she started really working with Panama, and we discovered over time Panama could hear. She probably was partially deaf, but as we treated her well, she started to slowly open up to us. Mm. But make no mistake, the lack of trust was there for the longest period of time. And it took a year to really get her to feel pretty comfortable around us and to know that she was in a safe place. Then she followed us everywhere. She was with us, and she couldn't crawl up in our laps, although she wanted to. So we would lift her up and put her in our laps because she had arthritis. But the trust was able to be regained. She always was wanting to trust, but we don't know what those people did in that second family, but whatever they did, it was something that didn't treat her very well. She was afraid to go in our garage, so we think they must have kept her locked in a garage. And we don't know what all. So we were able to break through those barriers, but I understand exactly what you're saying. Yeah. And it's partly why I say dogs don't automatically trust, but they're open to trust much more than humans are. We could learn a lot from dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we used to have, Paul Bailey, he had to be crated for like the first 6 to 7 months that we had him because of the operations mm-hmm. that he had to pin the leg. He wasn't allowed out, so we used to have to keep him on a tight leash, just gentle exercise, a lot of physiotherapy, like 4 or 5 times a day. And we did that all ourselves. And then eventually when, as he started to get better, then, we would take him for hydrotherapy. Mm-hmm. But it was very, very difficult at various points, and it did put a lot of strain on us. And there was a point where we had some friends that were like, oh, we'll find out if anybody wants to take him. Nobody wanted to, because nobody wants to take on a dog with problems. And also right. the other thing is that I don't think he'd ever, been housebroken before.
Yeah.
Because he, would just let go wherever. And fast forward, and people say, oh my God, he's amazing. He follows you around everywhere. And he's like, he dotes on you guys. And how the heck did you manage to get him from where he was to where he is today? And I just say to him, the short answer is love, mm-hmm. unconditional love.
And trust,
exactly.
And it's conveying the message, you're in a safe and a trusting home, and we gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what all families should do. We could learn a lot more from animals, dogs, and we have a rescue cat that we rescued 8 years ago, a family who lived near us. They were going to just take it to the pound because the wife had died and the husband was going to go live in an assisted living facility. Mm-hmm. And we said we would find the cat a home because we were living in an apartment and we at the time didn't want to have a cat in a confined space. The problem was when we asked the people, what was the cat's name? They told us the cat's name was Stitch. My wife has been a professional quilter since 1994. Do you think that cat was going to go anywhere? And so Stitch has been with us for 8 years and runs the house.
We have two cats too. We have a Bengal and we have a black and white Moggy who we rescued. And the four of them together, it's quite amazing. In front of us, Michael, it's like World War III. But when we're not looking, they're always together.
Yeah. It's an act. You know,
they're our children. They're all brothers and sisters. It's just awesome. So then you get through college and you enter the world of work. You go on to manage quite a large sales organization. What was that journey like into, you know, sort of interview process and finding work and so on? And what did you come up against? Because there had to have been some level, you must have met with some resistance or some level of, you know, people kind of prejudging and thinking that you wouldn't be able to do, you know, what able-sighted people can do, because there is a lot of that discrimination. It's not just people who are partially or have lack of sight, it's other disabilities as well. Because God knows my other half has had her share of things that she's had to deal with.
Well, the issue for me is I was very fortunate. In college, I joined a consumer organization called the National Federation of the Blind, mm-hmm. which is the largest consumer organization of blind people in the world, and also, of course, in the U.S. Mm. And a guy came to the office, the Washington office of the Federation. I was in my graduate years in 1974, I think. He came to the Washington office and he said, "My name is Ray Kurzweil. I have a machine that can look at a page of print and read it out loud for blind people, and I need to make it a commercially available product so that blind people can use it. Can you guys help me? Because nobody believes I can do it." And he was so convincing that he got the director of the Washington office to contact the president of the National Federation of the Blind and talk with him about it. And Jim Gashel from the Washington office said, "I think I should go look at this machine. It's up in Cambridge, Massachusetts." Mm-hmm. And the president at the time, Ken Jernigan, said, "Okay, if you think so." And Jernigan wasn't the most technologically oriented guy, but he was a visionary. And if there was any chance that this machine really worked, it was worth exploring. We're always hearing people say they got the greatest thing since sliced bread that is going to help blind people and all that. But in any case, we get those kinds of things. And Gashel wasn't sure that this wasn't the same thing, but he told Ray Kurzweil, you may have heard of him. He's a futurist and an inventor. He's invented the singularity, which is, in his theory, the time when human and computers will have their brains married together. But in any case, Gashel told Ray Kurzweil, "All right, I'm going to come up, but I don't want to see the machine read what you have. I'm going to bring my own stuff. And if it reads my stuff, then I'm interested." And Kurzweil said, "Bring it on." Not in those words, but that's what he said. And Jim Gashel went up, took magazines and books and other things, and my gosh, the machine read them. Made mistakes, but it read them. And so that began a relationship that actually exists through today with Kurzweil. Anyway, yeah. We created a foundation project. We got foundations to give us funds so that we could purchase five of the machines at $50,000 each. They were prototypes. That gave Ray the funding he needed. And we had additional funding to hire staff to deal with the machines. And the idea was that we were going to put machines all around the country for blind people to come and see and use and learn to use and give feedback as to what they liked, what they didn't like, what needed to be done to improve the machine and so on. And I was hired out of college after getting my master's degree in physics to be the guy who went everywhere day to day to deal with the machines, everything from fixing machines to placing machines, writing curriculum, teaching people to use the machines, observing people, all of that stuff. So literally, I lived out of suitcases, a toolbox, and in hotels with my second guide dog, Holland, for 18 months. Because anyway, any day I could be anywhere from Baltimore to San Francisco and in between. Mm-hmm. So after that job, I went to work for Kurzweil because they wanted to hire me to come in and do human factors studies like I'd been doing before. But I was there about 8 months when I was called into the office of the vice president of marketing. And he said, I have to tell you, we're going to lay you off. And I said, why? And he said, oh, it's not that you're doing a bad job. We like the work you're doing. But the problem is, like a lot of engineering firms, we hire too many non-revenue producers. We've got to get more revenue and we got to hire more people to bring in revenue. So we have to let you go. He paused and he said, unless you want to go into sales. But he said, I don't want you to sell the reading machine for the blind. I want you to sell our commercial version, which is about $125,000 unit, which was a commercial system that companies could buy to scan hundreds, thousands of pages of documents to put them in computer readable form. And so my only question to this VP of marketing, his name was Andrew Parsons, I said, but I don't know anything about sales. And he said, we'll get you into a Dale Carnegie sales course. And I took a 10-week Dale Carnegie sales course. And so I've been professionally selling, if you will, ever since. My first job was to sell in the New England states and through Canada. And then later, Xerox decided to buy Kurzweil, and Ray said he would sell. When I was asked to relocate out to California, because I was from there, and I was asked to help integrate Kurzweil into the Western world of Xerox. Mm. My thanks for that, by the way, along the way, once we moved back out here, I met the woman who I then married in 1982, Karen Ashurst, who became Karen Hingson, my wife. And my thanks for all of that was that when the purchase or the merger was consummated, all the Kurzweil salespeople were invited to leave because they weren't needed. Because what Xerox really wanted was just the technology. Big mistake, I think, but that's what they did. So then I had to go look for a job. And I kind of saw the writing coming. And so I was prepared, although it still was very frustrating knowing that now we don't have a safety net of a job. Mm-hmm. And I started looking for jobs. I had one executive recruiter who contacted me and said, we really are interested. We like your resume. We've lined up an interview for you to come up to San Jose, California to meet with the company. And the night before the interview, he called me back and he said, I was just looking at your resume one last time. And I see that you do a lot of stuff with blind people. Is there somebody who's blind in your family? And I said, yeah, me. You're blind? I'm going to have to call them. They're not going to want to interview you now. I said, wait a minute. You just told me, and you've been telling me right along that you like my resume. Mm. You knew I was qualified for the job, but now you're saying just because I'm blind, I'm not. That doesn't make sense. And anyway, the bottom line is the interview was canceled and the ticket that I had was voided. And so, yeah, the unemployment rate among employable blind people around the world and among most persons with disabilities is in the 60 to 70% range. Mm. And it's not that we can't work. It's that people don't think we can work. And today, especially, they miss out on the value of hiring a person with a disability because we know if we are offered and take a job, we know full well that there was a lot of work that went in to getting us that, for us to get that job and for people to deciding to give us the job. So we're going to stay loyal to people who are loyal to us. We're much more apt to be loyal to a company than is the average person who will just go to get more money and so on, because mm-hmm. we know how hard it is. So it is a constant thing that we face, this whole concept of discrimination. But when I couldn't get a job, I started my own company with a couple of other people, and we sold PC-based computer-aided design systems to architects. That was the company that we started. I didn't need to work the machine, but I learned how to work the machine so I could talk intelligently about it mm-hmm. and sit somebody down in front of it and so on. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff that happened. And I did that for 4 years, and I'm leading up to something with this. Chigang gets back to what you were talking about.
Yeah.
So in 1989, I decided that I wanted to go back into the workforce. We sold the company. My wife and I had been looking at newspapers, and one day she said, I've got a cool job. It's selling some revolutionary disk subsystems and computers and so on, and you would be perfect for this job. And she read me the ad, and I said, you're absolutely right. So I'll go off and send my resume, you know, do you think that I should say in my cover letter that I'm blind or not? Because if you don't say you're blind, you might get a response like anyone else would. If you say you're blind, you're pretty much guaranteed you won't even get a response.
Yeah.
For the same reason that that one company or that one recruiter decided that suddenly because I was blind, I wasn't qualified for the job. Anyway, when I said, should I say I'm blind or not? She said, you're a dummy. Wives can do that. You know, you're a dummy. And I said, well, why? She said, what is the most important thing you keep telling me that you tell every salesperson that you hire and every team that you work with and that you manage? And I said, well, I'm not quite sure which thing you're thinking of. And finally, she said, you have always said that the most important thing that anybody in sales should know is to turn perceived liabilities into assets. And that's extremely important. Turn perceived liabilities into assets. It's something I learned in the Dale Carnegie sales course. Well, this little light went on over my head and I went off and I wrote a cover letter. And the last two paragraphs of the cover letter went something like this. The most important thing you need to know about me is that I happen to be blind, because as a person who is blind, I have had to sell all of my life just to survive. I've had to sell to convince people to let me buy a house. I've had to sell to convince people to let me bring my guide dog into a grocery store because we didn't have the ADA, although we did have laws in California. I've had to sell to convince people to let me take my guide dog on an airplane, and sometimes there have been challenges with that, but I've had to sell. So when you're hiring someone for this job, do you want to hire somebody who comes in for 8 or 10 hours a day and then goes home because the job is over? Or do you want to hire someone who truly understands sales for the science and art that it is and sells 24 hours a day as a way of life? Turn perceived liabilities into assets. So we sent that letter off, and 2 weeks later, I got a call, and they said because of that letter, they wanted to interview me, and I got hired by them.
Awesome.
And that eventually led for them transferring me back to the East Coast to open an office for the company in 1996. And in 1999, I was recruited away by another company that asked me to open an office for them. It was for other products that we were resellers for. And I opened that office, and that was on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center, which got us up to there.
Yeah. We'll get onto that. I hate the term disabled, disability.
Disabled is not a good term. You know, we're not disabled people. We are persons with a disability, but as I point out, everyone is. But disability is a characteristic, and it should not be stigmatized like it is. And we've got to get over that. And people don't.
Yeah.
You know, we're viewed as less than other people are, and it continues to happen regularly. We talk about diversity. Well, diversity is a ship that sailed. Nobody talks about disabilities when we talk about diversity.
No, that's right.
We're not letting them do that with inclusion, however. Or we're trying to. They try to still say, well, we're inclusive, or to some degree, we're letting different races in. No, you're not inclusive. You don't deal with disabilities. And we need to really trumpet that to the world a lot more than so far we have.
Yeah. And, you know, I just find the term so devaluing of someone, really. You know, I know, I mean, my wife is an example. She's an absolutely incredible human being, you know, from a child being told everything that she wouldn't be able to do. And fast forward to today, I mean, the things that she's done, is able to do, has done, etc., you know, absolutely amazing.
Sure.
That, you know, any person who you know, you got someone who's got all the boxes checked, right? Hypothetically speaking.
Yeah.
It is nowhere near as capable as someone who, by society standards, doesn't. Right?
Disability.
We take things for granted.
Disability does not mean a lack of ability. And what we really need to learn to do is to recognize that everyone has skills and abilities, and our abilities and skills are different from each other, but that doesn't make any of us less.
Yeah. So you end up in the Twin Towers. which when I went to New York, which was the, must have been the year before, I think it was the year 2000, I went to New York for the first time. And we went into the lobby and there was a huge line to go on the tour. And I said to my friends, I'm not doing that. You know, maybe I'll do it the next time I come back. And but we went outside and my friend and I, we were craning our necks to look up at these amazing buildings. And in the end, we lay on the sidewalk in between the two towers and we just looked up because they just stretched into the sky like, you know, ad infinitum. They were absolutely amazing. But you end up in there and we all know what happened. I mean, I don't think there's anyone on that day that doesn't remember exactly where they were when they found out when the attack happened. And then the absolute horror that must, I can't even imagine what people were feeling that were in the building. If you don't mind, just take us back there. But then it's Roselle was your guide dog at the time, right?
Roselle was my guide dog, yes.
Yeah. So what happened? Where were you? And then how did Roselle help you get out of that nightmare?
Well, so first of all, a decision I made early on when I started working in the World Trade Center was to learn all I could about it. And especially when we opened the office on the 78th floor, I really wanted to know all I could about what to do in an emergency because I was the leader of the office. And I sometimes would be there by myself because I wanted my sales staff out selling. You know, I would go with them when they wanted me to. And I did different tasks for different salespeople I hired because, as I told each one of them, I'm not here to boss you around. I'm here to add value to help make you successful. So let's figure out how I can. So I would be out of the office a bunch, but also I would be in the office a bunch and oftentimes much more than they were. So I learned everything I could. I learned where things were. I met with the Port Authority police, the fire people, learned all I could about emergency evacuations and everything that I could possibly learn. I wandered around the World Trade Center, not using Roselle or, not using Roselle, but using a cane because I wanted to find all of the things that the dog would just naturally avoid, like kiosks where people would shop and so on. I wanted to learn where all that stuff was so that I could travel anywhere. And as I love to say, you could drug me and I'd wake up and within 5 or 10 seconds, I'd know exactly where I was in the World Trade Center. I really wanted to know it that well and learned it that well and learned everything about it. So I gained a mindset that said, you know what to do in an emergency. So on September 11th, we were going to be holding some seminars teaching some of our reseller partners how to sell our products. I was going to be in the office. The only other person from Quantum, the company that we worked for, who was there was David Frank, who came in from our corporate office in California because he was in charge of pricing and so on. So I was going to do the presentations, the technical stuff, and David would then be there to talk about pricing, but I would be their principal contact anyway. So David and I were in my office. Some early arrivals were there from one of our distributors, Ingram Micro. They were the ones that were bringing all the different resellers in. And so David and I were in my office and the Ingram people were actually in our conference room where we were going to be doing the seminars and they were eating breakfast. And at 8:45, we felt the building kind of lurch. Now, at that very moment, I was reaching for letterhead because we needed to print a list of all the people who would be coming to the seminars. We needed to print it on letterhead and fax it to the Port Authority people so that they could then compare the names with names on IDs and let people come up. And so I was reaching for letterhead. We heard a kind of a muffled thump and explosion. The building kind of lurched, and then it started moving in one direction, just tipping and tipping and tipping. We moved probably about 20 feet, as I describe it. And what was happening was, and what you need to understand is that tall buildings like that are big springs. They're made to flex in windstorms. And if it had only been an airplane hitting the tower without a lot of jet fuel on it, the building would have survived. But it was struck, the building was struck by an airplane full of 26,000 pounds of jet fuel. So it was a deliberate attempt using the most fuel that it could have. And the infrastructure was more destroyed because of the exploding fuel that caused it to collapse. But in any case, at that moment, we had no idea what was going on. Of course, later people kept telling me, well, you didn't know because you couldn't see it. No, you don't understand. Superman and X-ray vision don't exist. Nobody where we were knew what was going on. The building was struck 18 floors above us on the other side of the building. Nobody around us knew what happened. So the building tipped, and David and I couldn't figure out what was happening, of course. And David wasn't blind, by the way. And of course, as I said, still couldn't figure out what was going on. We actually said goodbye to each other because we thought we were about to take a 78-floor plunge to the street when the building stopped and it started coming back the other way.
Yeah.
And eventually it got vertical. As soon as it did, I moved from where I was. I had gone over to the doorway and was just standing in the doorway. I grew up in a town where we had experienced earthquakes, building moves, go to doorway. Well, 78 floors up isn't going to really matter, but I still had the habit. So I went to the doorway and was standing there until the building got vertical. I went back into the build to our office and I met Roselle coming out from under my desk. I took her leash. I told her to heel, which meant to come around on my left side and sit. She did. She sat down and the building dropped straight down about 6 feet. Now, the reason it dropped is because the springs, the leaves, if you will, of the springs went back to their normal configuration. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. After that, David looked out the window and he started shouting, "Oh my God, Mike, there's fire and smoke above us. We got to get out of here right now. We can't stay here." And I could hear noises outside the window, and I was wondering what they were. And now he told me it was all these papers brushing by our window on fire, millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside our window. And David kept saying, "We got to get out of here." And I said, "Slow down, David." "No, we got to get out of here right now. The building's on fire. We can't stay here." "Slow down, David. We'll get out." "No, we got to get out of here." "David, slow down." And then he used the big line. "You don't understand. You can't see it." Of course, that's what we always default back to. The problem, however, wasn't what I wasn't seeing. It was what David wasn't seeing. Roselle is afraid of thunderstorms. And I know what she's like when she's afraid. At that moment, however, she was sitting there wagging her tail, yawning, going, "Who woke me up?" She was not exhibiting any kind of fear. And if there were any smoke that she could detect or anything else that she could sense that would say, we got to be worried about this, she would have reacted much differently than that. And she didn't.
Yeah.
So I was observing this dog who was totally calm that told me whatever was happening wasn't such an urgent thing that we had to run in panic from the door and go to a place to get out. And it wouldn't have been an elevator, by the way, because I had been told in any kind of situation, especially where there's fire, don't take the elevators, which was, of course, right that day. Anyway, I finally got David to focus and I said, "Get our guests to the stairs. Don't let them take the elevators because if fire's in the elevators, they'll be doomed." So he got them to the stairs. I called my wife and told her that something had happened. It hadn't even hit the media yet. It was like about 2 minutes after the building was hit. Then David came back. We swept the offices. Nobody was there. We went to the stairs and we started down. And again, there was nobody who knew what had happened. But when we got into the stairwell, I started smelling an odor and it was familiar, but I couldn't place it. And it took me about four floors to realize I was smelling the fumes from burning jet fuel because I've been to a lot of airports. I did like 100,000 miles of travel a year for my company. And so I observed that to everybody around me. "Hey, you guys, that smell is burning jet fuel." And other people said, "Yeah, that's what it is. We must have been hit by an airplane." No one knew, right? How could they? So the point is that we figured out we must have been hit by an airplane, had no details. There were a few times that people started to lose it on the stairs. When we got about 10 floors down, a woman stopped and said, "I can't go on. I can't breathe." And we all surrounded her and Roselle gave her kisses. And I just said, "Come on, you can do it. Let's keep going. You can do it." Other people said, "Yeah, come on, you can do it." And at the 50th floor, David suddenly said, "Mike, we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here." I noticed he was getting a little quiet. And so I just literally and very deliberately snapped at him, "David, stop it. If Roselle and I can go down these stairs, so can you." And he told me later that brought him out of his funk. What he then said was that he was going to do something to get his mind off of whatever was going on. He was going to walk a floor below me and shout up to me everything that he saw as he was going down the stairs. I said, okay. I didn't need him to do that, but it would help him. And I didn't even realize what an important thing it was that he did. But when I got to the 49th floor, he was already at 48. And he's going, Mike, I'm at the 48th floor. All's good here. Go down another floor. Hey, I'm at floor 47, going down. And he did that all the way down the stairs. Why was it such an important thing? Because anyone who could hear him suddenly had something to fix on.
Yeah.
A voice that said, I'm okay. He had to keep thousands of people from panicking as we went down the stairs. And we were able to go down the stairs. We met firefighters coming up the stairs and so on along the way. And we finally got down to the bottom at about 9:35 and got into the lobby. They wouldn't let us go out of the doors into the outside from the lobby. We learned later it's because people were jumping from above, right above where the doors were. They wanted us to go as far away from the towers as we could to exit, which meant going all the way across the complex. So we did. We got outside. And then David saw fire in Tower 2 and said, I see fire up there. And I said, what's that all about? We had no idea. We didn't feel anything when we were in the stairwell. We walked over to Broadway. We turned left or north on Broadway, and we started to walk. And so we were on the west side of the street. There was a building on my left, and we eventually got to Vesey Street. We stopped there because David said I could see really the pyre in Tower 2 very clearly because we were closer to it. And he said, I want to take pictures. I tried to call my wife on the phone again, and I couldn't get through because the circuits were busy. As we now know, people were saying farewell to loved ones. But David took his pictures. I had just put my phone away, and David was putting his camera away when suddenly a police officer yelled, get out of here. It's coming down now. We heard this rumble that became this deafening roar. The best way to describe the sound from my perspective was it was kind of a combination of a freight train and a waterfall. You could hear metal clattering and glass breaking, and then this white noise sound of the building, Tower 2, pancaking down and collapsing. Everyone turned and ran. David ran. He was gone. I turned 180 degrees with Roselle and now was running south on Broadway with a building to my right. I got to the next street, now going back south, which was Fulton Street, turned right, and ran about 25 yards and suddenly caught up to David because David realized that he had just left and was going to come back, but we found him first. So he and I then started to run, and we just kept going and eventually got to a place where we were being covered by all the dirt and debris and the dust. We were getting hit by the dust clouds. And we couldn't see. And with every breath I took, I could feel stuff going down my throat and settling in my lungs. David said he couldn't see his hand 6 inches in front of his nose. And so we kept running now with this building on my right. And we were trying to find a door to get inside the building. And I kept telling Roselle, right, right, using hand signals, basically saying, go into the nearest entrance. I don't know whether she could hear me or she could even see hand signals. But she must have been able to. But suddenly I heard an opening and Roselle immediately turned right. So she knew what I wanted. She took one step and stopped and wouldn't move. And she just stood there. Come on, Roselle, keep going. She wouldn't move. And I realized she's doing what she's supposed to do. There's got to be a reason she stopped. And I investigated and found that we were at the top of a flight of stairs. So we went down the stairs and found ourselves in a little arcade lobby to the subway station, the Fulton Street subway station. We were there for a few minutes, and then a gentleman came up and introduced himself to us, and there were about 8 or 9 of us there, and the guy's name was Lou. He's an employee of the subway system. And he said, I'll take you down to an employer locker room. So we followed him down, and we were there for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then a police officer came and said we needed to leave. The air was better up above, and we couldn't stay where we were. So we followed him back up, and we got outside, and David looked around and said, oh my God, Mike, there's no Tower 2 anymore. And I said, what do you see? And he said, all I see are pillars of smoke hundreds of feet tall. We stood there a moment, then we just turned and continued west on Fulton Street. We walked for about 10 minutes, and then we heard that freight train waterfall sound again, and we figured it must have been our tower collapsing. David looked back and said, yeah, and there's another dust cloud coming. it's pretty confined. We got behind a little retaining wall and ducked down and just waited till everything passed. And then we got up and David said, "Oh my God, there's no World Trade Center anymore." And I said, "What do you see?" And he said, "All I see are fingers of fire and flames hundreds of feet tall and pillars of smoke. It's just all gone." So we stood there a couple minutes, and then I tried to call my wife again, and this time I got through, and she's the first one who told us how two aircraft had deliberately been crashed into the towers, one into the Pentagon, and a fourth was still missing over Pennsylvania. So we worked to get up toward Midtown Manhattan all that day, and eventually that night I was able to catch a train. They started to move again, going to New Jersey. We lived in Westfield, New Jersey, so I took a train. David walked back up to where he was staying on the Upper East Side with his sister who lived there. And so I took a train and I got home about 7 o'clock. And a friend of ours, a friend that Karen's known since high school, who also happened to move to New Jersey, Tom Painter, drove her to the train station to pick me up. And we went home and we just sort of started decompressing and trying to figure out what it all meant. The next day, I called Guide Dogs for the Blind, where I'd gotten all of my dogs, because some of the people there had been to the World Trade Center, and we took them up to our office and so on. And so I called, and among other people, spoke with Joanne Ritter, who is our public information officer at Guide Dogs. And she said, "Can I write a story? And you'll probably be pretty visible, and you want to be on TV." And I said, "Well, whatever." And she said, "What show do you want to be on first?" And I said, flippantly, I said, "Larry King Live." And then on the 14th of September, 3 days after the events, I had the first of 5 appearances on Larry King Live. And Larry also eventually wrote the foreword to Thunderdog. And it kind of went from there. People started calling and asking if I would come and speak. And I decided it was a lot more fun to sell philosophy than it was to sell computers. And people wanted to hire me to come in and speak to their organizations and talk about trust and teamwork and leadership and moving on from unexpected emergencies and talking about the human-animal bond. And Guide Dogs also offered me a position as their public spokesperson. So I took that and we moved back to California. So I traveled and spoke both for Guide Dogs and just continuing to speak. And I spoke for Guide Dogs for 6.5 years, and then they ended the job. A new CEO came on and said nobody's interested in September 11th anymore. So they phased out the job. And so I was on my own. I formed the Michael Hingson Group and have been doing it ever since, traveling and speaking and talking about teamwork, talking about management styles, talking about some of the things we've talked about today. And I've been to places all over the world and enjoy it. The pandemic has slowed some of that down. And along the way, I also was able to connect with a company called Accessibee, A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E, capital B. And Accessibee is a company that manufactures products to help make websites more inclusive and accessible for persons with a variety of disabilities. And among other things, they asked me if I would do a podcast for them. And so we started Unstoppable Mindset in August of 2021. And we've been doing it ever since. So having a lot of fun with it. And that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
Thank you. Wow. So much. I was right there with you. I'm a very visual person, which is probably why I do the job that I do. And I was right there with you, Michael. I'm speechless, which is very rare for me on this show.
Well, I hope that some of the people will want us to come and tell the story, and they can find me. That's I'm easy. They can go to michaelhingson.com, michaelhingson.com. They can email me at michaelhi@accessibee.com. If they want to learn more about the podcast, they can go to michaelhingson.com/podcast or find it wherever you can find a podcast. And if anybody listens to episodes, of course, I hope they'll give us a 5-star rating. They can go to iTunes or wherever and rate, but absolutely, we really appreciate people listening, but always looking for speaking opportunities. And also we want to help people make their websites more inclusive. If they go to Accessibee, accessibee.com, there's a place where they can go on that where they can click a link and do a free website audit of their site. The system will look at their site and describe what's accessible, what's not accessible, what needs to be done. Then they can choose to use Accessibility, which is like a $500 a year product that'll fix a lot of the accessibility issues, and the things that it won't, the Accessibility staff or they can hire their own programmers can finish. But it's a really neat system. It works well, and it really makes a difference in making websites more usable for people who are blind or who have other kinds of disabilities. If, for example, you're a person with epilepsy, you go to a website with blinking elements, it could cause you seizures. And Accessibility's product can stop the blinking and use other technologies to get your attention to what they want you to see.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Extremely. I'm gonna make sure that I have all of those links there. People can also connect with you on LinkedIn, right?
Always on LinkedIn. We're there. We're on Facebook at M Hingson. And awesome. The quickest way for me to see things is email. So, you know, but we'll connect however. And again, if they go to michaelhingson.com, there's a contact form there and so on as well.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Michael, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you again, because as Michael so eloquently told me with a cheeky smile before we started recording, he charges for appearing on podcasts like mine. And the price, Michael, is?
You have to come on to Unstoppable Mindset now.
I can't wait. Yeah, so just...
it's cheap at twice the price.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that we get to meet you in person. I hope that a speaking opportunity comes up that will bring me to London. I've been to Ireland, but I've not actually been to London.
Oh.
So I'd love to do it. It would be fun to do, and hopefully it will come along.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if that opportunity comes up, then make sure you let me know. And
I'll leave it in your hands to find it. It's your job.
Yep. No, I accept the responsibility. Michael, thank you so, so much. I look forward to seeing you soon. So we'll get that recording date booked. As I've said previously, I'll make sure that all your links are in the show notes. You know, we will do everything we can to shine a light on your amazing work. Thank you for everything you do through your public speaking, through the book, through sharing your story time and time again, through your advocacy. You're absolutely amazing. Thank you. You're an example to all of us.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to have been able to come on the podcast. I'm glad we had a chance to do it. And looking forward to having you on and finding ways to work together.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for joining Michael and I today. Hit the share button to send this podcast on to someone you know who could benefit from the things that Michael shared in this episode. You can find us on Instagram at Tailoring Talk Podcast for updates on new episodes. And you know I love feedback, so email me at tailoringtalkpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to support the show further, you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Roberto Rivilla. Have a great week. Be good to each other, and I'll see you tailoring talkers on the next one.